May it please the court, David Sterling on behalf of appellants Halliburton Company and David Lassar. The district court below erred by granting class certification without considering appellants' rebuttal proof that severed the link between the alleged misrepresentations and the price of the Halliburton stock in question. The district court's errors manifest in multiple ways. It is contrary to this court's unbroken line of precedent. It is contrary to the basic opinion itself. It was contrary to the Supreme Court's opinion in this case. It was contrary to Federal Rule of Evidence 301, on which BASIC relied. And it was contrary to Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 23. Let me start first with this court's precedents. This court has consistently and uniformly recognized that whenever a plaintiff in a fraud on the market class action securities case invokes the presumption, the defendant is entitled to rebut it, particularly at the class certification stage. This court recognized that in Unger in 2005, in Oscar Private Equity, in Flowserve, and in this case. This court has always recognized that if the plaintiff is going to invoke the fraud on the market presumption of class-wide reliance, the defendant has a right to rebut it at that stage. Now, it is important to note that when this case went up to the Supreme Court, what the fund argued was that the defendants do not have a right at the class certification stage to rebut the class-wide presumption of reliance by showing no price impact. That was what the fund argued. The Supreme Court did not address that question. The Supreme Court simply held that price impact is not loss causation. Loss causation is a familiar concept in the securities laws. Loss causation is not a fraud on the market prerequisite that has to be proven at class certification. And therefore, as the Supreme Court said, we do not address anything else about BASIC, its presumption, or how or when it can be rebutted. By doing so, the Supreme Court left undisturbed this court's holdings in Unger and Oscar and Flowserve and this case that a defendant can and is entitled to rebut the class-wide presumption of fraud on the market reliance with proof that the alleged misrepresentations did not affect the stock price at class certification. Now, the fund's position.
Let's review. Now, which one did you agree that the Supreme Court decided they didn't have to offer proof of at the class certification stage?
Our position at the Supreme Court was that in order to invoke the presumption of reliance, a plaintiff must put on a prima facie case of market efficiency, publicity, and that's it. At that point in time, the burden shifts to the defendant to rebut it, to put on some proof that a reasonable fact finder could conclude severs the link between the alleged misrepresentation.
I thought I heard you say the Supreme Court made some determination that there was something that the one seeking class certification didn't have to do at the class.
Does not have to prove loss causation.
All right.
In the Dura sense. And actually, in the Supreme Court, we agreed with that, Judge Graves. We did not defend loss causation as a fraud on the market prerequisite in the Supreme Court. Our position in the Supreme Court was that while this court used the phrase loss causation in multiple occasions in the opinion, what the court really required was price impact. And price impact, as we all know, especially after Dura, is not the same thing as loss causation. And what the Supreme Court held in this case,
it's not the same thing, but it's a necessary component of it. In your opposition to class certification here, your argument about price impact was a subcomponent of no loss causation. Now, that may be because you thought our law had sort of pushed you that direction.
Correct, Your Honor. In the proceedings below, both sides were following to the letter the Oscar Private Equity calculus. In their motion for class certification, they began by saying, we recognize the burden under Oscar, and here's how we prove loss causation, showing what everybody called loss causation under Oscar, but was really price impact, because it recognized there were two ways to prove it. One was price inflation following an alleged misrepresentation. The other was deflation following a corrective disclosure.
So loss causation is always going to have those two elements, inflation through the misrepresentation, then disclosure, at which point the correction occurs, and the loss is the length between the two.
Loss causation in the fraud on the market context will have that.
Yes.
However, What must be kept in mind, Your Honor, is that the fraud on the market presumption of reliance is just one way to prove reliance. It's one mode. The other mode, the traditional mode, still applies. Any shareholder can still allege, leaving aside fraud on the market.
The reason I'm still stuck a little bit on loss causation, not just because that was a 9-0 reversal of us, is because to the extent that the next ruling affirming the Ninth Circuit, Amgen, has logic to it, am I mistaken that that's Judge Easterbrook's logic? And he says, all right, well, materiality, if you're always if the common proof would be the same, we're in the same predicament that we were in Amgen. Even if it's not an element of the fraud, in order the price impact would still be stuff that would mean if it doesn't exist, if there's no price distortion, no price impact, the entire class can never win. So the Easterbrook logic will be you're going to win at the merit stage.
Not quite, Your Honor. Okay. Here's why. You are absolutely correct as to the fundamental holding of Amgen. Amgen says there are multiple fraud on the market prerequisites. There's market efficiency. There's publicity. There's materiality. But it says materiality is different from the other two because materiality is, to use the phrase of the majority opinion in Amgen, it's an indispensable element of the 10b-5 cause of action. A failure of proof on materiality, by definition, kills everybody's claim. There is no individual claim left. Price impact
and loss causation would do the same. Loss causation.
We're just talking about the reliance.
I know, but if that logic would still apply if price impact is a necessary component of loss causation. No?
Not quite.
Okay.
And here's why. Loss causation itself is not a 10b-5 element. I'm aware of no case in any jurisdiction that, in reciting the elements of a 10b-5 claim, says price impact is one. And this Court has recognized, going back to 2000.
You're not using now loss causation and price impact interchangeably, are you?
No, I'm not. You're
because
right.
You're losing me.
Right.
You're trying to tell me one no longer applies, the other one does, but it sounds like the same evidence would be used in support of either argument.
In a fraud
Is that not true?
You're right, Your Honor. In a fraud on the market context, the same evidence that we put in below under the rubric of loss causation directly goes to reliance, and it rebuts any inference of or presumption of class-wide reliance. It's the same evidence under a different argument. But here's the distinction. Price impact per se, or the failure on this record to prove price impact, does not doom the entire class.
Why is that?
For two reasons, Your Honor. First of all, this is subject to the battle of the experts. An individual shareholder who opts out of the class, which, by the way, is a trend everybody's seeing these days, more and more large institutional shareholders are opting out of these class actions, could hire their own expert and do, candidly, a better job than the plaintiff's expert did, and with a properly constructed index, a well-done methodology, may be able to prove price impact. This record, however, is binding on this class, and on this record.
So you're saying you could get a court to rule for you on the issue of price impact, but then have somebody later offer up sufficient proof that the earlier ruling was in fact incorrect?
That's right. First of all, Your Honor, the findings at the class certification stage are not binding on the ultimate fact finder. That was the point that this Court made in FlowServe. So class certification findings have no effect on a jury or bench trial down the road. And so an institutional shareholder could come out and have do a better job than the fund did on the issue of price impact and could show price impact, theoretically.
Well, couldn't you just say the same thing about materiality?
No, Your Honor. Materiality is it's an objective standard. Materiality is what would a reasonable shareholder deem important, to phrase it more properly. Materiality asks, would a reasonable shareholder consider this evidence important in deciding what to do. That finding applies to everybody. There's nothing subjective about it. Now, there's another way, though, that this record on price impact doesn't doom all class members, and that's this. All this record does right now is it defeats the class-wide presumption of reliance. It means that shareholders can still, if they want, go back to the traditional mode.
When you say price impact, are you saying your position is a public misrepresentation may not have impacted the price, and therefore you prevail.
Based upon this record, Judge,
is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. Based upon the record that was developed below, that Judge,
but you're telling me that there could be inconsistent findings on that issue sufficient that a ruling as regards a claim and a class certification wouldn't then have any application to subsequent claims by individual shareholders.
Correct, Your Honor. The class certification.
Do you have any case where there's been a finding of materiality and no price impact?
But there's a difference between materiality and
a case where that's happened.
Well, I don't know offhand, Your Honor, but I would point out that this court in 2001, in the Nathanson versus Zonagin opinion, this court recognized that price impact is not materiality. Price impact goes to reliance. In that case, the district court on a 12B6 motion looked at whether there was price impact for any alleged misrepresentation or any alleged corrective disclosure. And the district court, for each alleged misrepresentation that didn't move the market, dismissed on materiality grounds. It said, no price impact, immaterial as a matter of law. What this court did on appeal was notable for two reasons. First, this court did not say you can't look at price impact even at a 12B6. This court said that was the right thing to do. What this court then said is price impact goes to reliance, not to materiality.
I mean, they're ordinarily considered a proxy for the other, isn't it?
No, Your Honor. Well, I will say this much, Judge Davis.
I mean, ordinarily.
They're
the same thing, aren't they?
Not necessarily, and here's why.
No, when I say ordinarily.
Ordinarily. I'll spot you that. As a general proposition, an immaterial misrepresentation or statement will not move the market. But the converse is not true. All the time there are statements made that are material in the TSC versus Northway sense that don't move the market. And let me give you an example. Let's assume that today company ABC announces that the CEO is taking early retirement and they're bringing in some new guy. In the TSC calculus, is that material information? Is that information that a reasonable shareholder would deem important in deciding what to do? Absolutely. Of course it's material. But is that necessarily going to move the market? No. Some analysts and market commentators may think that's a good thing for the company. Some might think it's a bad thing for the company. Is it definitely going to move the needle of the stock price in a statistically significant amount? No. It might, but there's no reason to think that it definitely would. And so this court has always correctly recognized the disconnect between materiality, an objective standard, and price impact.
What about loss causation? Could the plaintiff win in that situation if it didn't move the market?
Not in a fraud in the market context. If in the fraud in the market context, the plaintiff cannot show price impact, they won't show loss causation. But in the traditional sense of proving reliance, in which the investor subjectively saw the misrepresentation, relied upon it, in that context, it could. And in fact, there are numerous cases that recognize that when a plaintiff shareholder is suing on the traditional.
You said subjectively did what to the misrepresentation?
Subjectively relied on the misrepresentation, not relying on the integrity. I'm sorry?
I thought you said subjectively saw the misrepresentation.
Oh, yeah.
I just misheard you.
Yeah, no. If an investor says, I read the misrepresentation and I relied on it in buying the stock, that's fine.
The expert, your expert in this case, I know your time's getting very short, but your expert, Ms. Allen?
Yes.
This may be a very simple question. Did she conclude no price impact because market it was inefficient, or did she conclude efficient market still no price impact?
No, I don't believe she conveyed any opinion on market efficiency.
Do you concede, though, in this record, market efficiency?
In the binary sense, if you have to say a market is efficient or inefficient, I think most people would say Halliburton trades the New York Stock Exchange, it's efficient. However, there is a growing recognition that that is far too simplistic an analysis, and markets are not binary yes
but
or no.
One could look at Amgen and the Supreme Court reversal of us to be basically saying, wait, I don't want basic being battled over at the Rule 23 stage much at all. Yes as to publicity, yes as to timing, and yes as to market efficiency, but nothing beyond that.
Well, the first problem with that, Your Honor, is the fact that this Court has long recognized that its precedent, your precedent, is not overturned sub silentio by a Supreme Court opinion unless it expressly says so.
Okay.
And that's Pilgrim's Pride and other cases. And my time is up, but if I can finish this sentence. And it's important to bear in mind that this issue was expressly not decided by the Supreme Court in this case, and it was expressly not decided in Amgen either.
All right. Thank you, sir. Mr. Boyd.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is David Boies. I represent the plaintiffs. In November of 2008, the District Court ordered on our motion for class certification, stated that the parties did not dispute that class certification was appropriate except for a single issue, and that single issue was loss causation. When the United States Supreme Court in this case held that loss causation did not have to be established at the class certification stage, this case went back down to the District Court. The District Court had another hearing, and the District Court held that we had satisfied the class certification requirements, that common questions of law and fact predominated. On this appeal, what Halliburton claims is that because there is not a what they call a price impact, class certification either should not be granted or we ought to have a mini trial on the question of price impact. I've got three basic points. The first point is that the Amgen case, decided by the United States Supreme Court within last month, makes clear that because proof of price impact is common and is essential to the merits claims of the alleged members of our class, that proof is tested at trial and perhaps at summary judgment stage, but it is not tested at the class certification stage.
But that would be true. Your expert, is it pronounced Netsheim?
Yes.
If Ms. Netsheim had said, even on December 7th, there was zero fluctuation, when the asbestos exposure evidence was revealed, no, if both experts had agreed, no market adjustment, you would still say that the presumption, the market fraud presumption, cannot be challenged at the Rule 23 stage?
If she had said that there was no price impact,
yes,
we wouldn't have a case. In other words,
well, that's true, and that's the Easterbrook Amgen rationale.
Exactly.
But that's separate from saying, you know, there is a distinction, and I think it was your brief, Chief Justice Roberts, pointed that out. You may conclusively win at the merit stage, but why is it that she wouldn't be able to say that the original presumption doesn't exist? Why wouldn't Halliburton be able to assert that unless it's become a mandatory presumption? Let me rephrase my question. What aspect of the basic concept is still rebuttable in your viewpoint?
Publicity,
just
for example. Just the three elements you mentioned earlier.
I see. Okay.
And I think that the
But that would mean sub silentio, a lot of our case law is no longer good.
Well, I'm not sure it's sub silentio. In Amgen, the Court was very clear. You could not have been more express than the Court was in Amgen. The Court says in Amgen, if you have a question where the proof is going to be common and the class is going to class claims are going to rise or fall on the merits of that determination.
Mm-hmm.
There is no basis to have that determined at the class certification stage.
Do you read that as saying both those conditions have to be met?
I think so, Your Honor. They do say, it's a little ambiguous, they say first and then they say second. And I think you could argue that if either one of them had been met, it wouldn't be. But I think the better reading of it, frankly, is that we have to establish both of those two things. Counsel said he was aware of no case that had held that loss causation was an essential element of a 10b-5 case. I would direct the Court's attention to the Amgen case, where at page 4 of the Westlaw version of it, the starred page 4, it lists the six elements of a private action under 10b-5. And number 5 is economic loss, and number 6 is loss causation. So if there's a question, if there was a question before Amgen as to whether loss causation was an essential element of a 10b-5 case, and I don't think after Durer there should have been any doubt. But if there was any doubt, the Amgen court clearly resolved that issue. Now, if you go all the way back to Basic, in the Basic decision and famous footnote 29, the court there says this proof, this rebuttal proof, is for trial. And although there may have been some dubiety about whether the court really meant what it said in that footnote, in Amgen, the Supreme Court makes absolutely clear that that's what it meant. It quotes that language, and it says this is for trial or perhaps for summary judgment, but it's not for the class certification stage.
The trouble, I mean, but you, I'm sure remembering footnotes, the text accompanying footnote 28 gives as an example of breaking the link, the example that if price wouldn't have been affected by the misrepresentation, quote, the causal connection could be broken.
Exactly. And Your Honor, what it says then is it says that, and then it drops this footnote 29.
Yeah.
And it says that's proof for trial. And it says you can adjust the class certification at trial if you need to. And in Amgen, Amgen said, well, that's outdated now because of the amendment of Rule 23 and no more conditional class certification. And the Supreme Court expressly in the Amgen opinion says, no, that is still valid law because even under the current Rule 23, you can amend the class certification at trial. So that I suggest that the Court could not have been clearer in the Amgen opinion that this determination where you have a issue that's going to be determined by common proof and that the claims that the class is asserting are going to rise or fall without determination, that is for summary judgment and trial. It is not for class certification. And remember, Your Honor,
was there anything in their expert's testimony that wouldn't have applied to all plaintiffs in common?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Is that an important way to think about it? For me to I guess what I'm getting back is to the three elements that the Supreme
right.
Court defined in Basic. You're agreeing that you could still try to rebut the presumption if you could attack those three.
If you could attack those three, yes, Your Honor.
And examples of that would be some overriding other news event that even though it's misrepresentation, the market doesn't adjust because it's sort of been crowded out?
Well, I think that when you have market efficiency and you have publicity and you have the purchase of the stock after the misrepresentation but before the truth is revealed, I think you have the requirements for class certification. I think that, I mean, take December 7th. I mean, December 7th, the stock drops $3.8 billion of market cap, 42% of the value of the stock. Because their expert admits that nothing happened on December 7th except to reveal information about their asbestos exposure. Their asbestos exposure was repeatedly claimed by them, by Halliburton, to be taken care of by their reserves. They repeatedly, over and over again, and I want to give the court some reference sites here, 4240, 4265, 4274, 4276, 4596, repeatedly asserted that their asbestos reserves were adequate. It became clear on December 7th that that was false. Now, the issue as to whether their prior statements were made with or without Sienter is clearly a matter that's not to be tested at class certification stage. It is clearly a issue that is subject to common proof and goes to the merits, is essential to the merits, Sienter. So they cannot claim here that they are rebutting the fact that they said falsely and knowingly falsely that their reserves were adequate. There is no evidence in the record that anything happened on December 7th other than the proof that their reserves were not accurate. When they talk about price impact, and this is really my second point after Amgen, when they talk about price impact, they're really talking about loss causation. Because what they're saying is not only did the stock price go down, we prove that, nobody disputes that. They're saying that the decline in price was not related to, was not linked to the misrepresentation. That is loss causation. That's not price impact. That's loss causation. Because when...
But the Supreme Court dicta then in this case and trying to draw the distinction between price impact and loss causation is just is because price impact is a subcomponent of it?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah. That's exactly right. And that's what they said below. They said price impact is a necessary but not sufficient condition. And you have price impact in the very narrow sense when the stock drops. That is a price impact. The question under loss causation is, was that price impact related to, caused by, the misrepresentation? Now, in this particular case, we have their expert saying there was no other reason for the decline other than the asbestos information. And that asbestos information proved that the prior statements that their reserves were adequate was not accurate. Now, they have said below, and I'm sure we will hear this at trial, those prior statements were genuine. They meant those. They had basis for believing that. They weren't lying. They were telling what they believed to be the truth at the time. But that all goes to the question of scienter. And scienter is clearly not something that can be litigated at the class certification stage. Now, to go back just for a second.
Is Halliburton correct when they say that even if they prove that the stock price was not affected, that individual class members might still have a claim? I think that's what they argue.
Well, they do, Your Honor, but not these individual class members, not the members of this class. And remember,
they do what?
Would not have a claim. In other words, if there's no claim here, if they were right that there's no price impact, there is no damages. Price impact is a component of loss causation. They said it. The Supreme Court has said it. If it's a component of loss causation, and if loss causation is an element of a 10b-5 claim, we can't win without price impact. Nobody can win.
Well, is price impact also an element of materiality or not?
I think as a practical matter, it is, Your Honor. The Supreme Court, every court that's ever talked about materiality and price impact have linked the two. I don't know of any case that has said that you can have something that is material without a price impact. As the court said in Amgen, clever minds can conjure up all sorts of unrealistic hypotheticals. But as in a real-world case, I think price impact and materiality are linked. Certainly, price impact and loss causation are linked. And that's really, maybe the more critical issue. Because if price impact and loss causation are linked, then you have common proof, and you have proof that is essential to prevailing on the merits. Now, they say that you could have individual people who did not rely on public statements. They say in their letter brief to the court, they say, well, you could conjure up somebody who didn't rely on the public statements but only had private statements. There's no allegation of that in the complaint. That's not this case. And none of the class plaintiffs in this case, none of the alleged members of the class, to use the Amgen language, Amgen talks about whether the alleged claims of the alleged members of the class will rise or fall on this issue. Their claims will rise or fall on this issue because that's the only thing that's in this case. The only alleged misrepresentations in this case are public misrepresentations. But even if they weren't, even if that were not the case, you still have to prove price impact in order to get any damages, in order to prove loss causation, which Amgen says is an essential element. I also want to just mention the third point that we make, which is that having not disputed anything other than loss causation at the time of the 2008 class certification hearing, they cannot now come in and say, well, we really rebutted some other aspect. I heard some ambiguity here about whether they were conceding that this was an efficient market. They've conceded that that was an efficient market at every stage of this proceeding, at every stage of that proceeding up until this afternoon. They have said this is an efficient market. So you can't take back all of those concessions and say, well, now we're going to say, well, it's not really an efficient market. Now we're going to say, well, there really wasn't a price impact. Having told the court, when it was before the court initially, that price impact was a necessary but not sufficient condition. And they went on and argued about loss causation. Having lost that argument in the Supreme Court, they're now trying to go back and recraft the argument that they're making here.
Well, in all honesty, though, our cases led them in that direction, did they not? I mean, didn't we say that if the contest is in the area that they're making, you better phrase it in loss causation.
What this court had said was that in addition to everything else you've got to prove loss causation. Now, they could very well have made a tactical judgment that said, we believe that we can defeat loss causation. Fifth Circuit told us that's all we have to do. Therefore, we're not going to make these other arguments. But as Judge Dennis pointed out when he said this court shouldn't even take this appeal, the issue of price impact and all of the other elements have been something that have been known to be available to them as defenses since 1988. So this is not a situation in which something that they thought was a remedy was not. This is a situation in which something they thought was a remedy turns out not to have been a effective argument, and the question is whether they were misled into not using other arguments. I think that misapprehends the way we practice law. If we've got two good arguments, even if we think one's a winner, we don't give up the other.
I mean, at a narrow level, it, to a certain extent, what they're saying is they weren't even allowed to supplement. And if there's any concession now that market efficiency is still a debatable point, and they might have evidence that goes to that, true, price impact is a component of loss causation, but it might also separately go to reliance. And therefore, it's dissimilar from materiality and loss causation, which are elements of the fraud, and it goes to reliance. And without that portion, you can't have the presumption. That's their argument.
If you didn't have an efficient market, if they rebutted the efficiency of market, I would agree with the court.
But there's no suggestion their request to supplement was to go to that point.
None whatsoever, Your Honor. Not till this afternoon. And I didn't even really hear him say he's going to contend that the market for Halliburton stock, which is widely traded, SEC filings, multi-billion-dollar market. I think half a billion shares outstanding is not an efficient market. I think that would not be a credible argument, even if they tried to make it. But I want to emphasize in the last 20 seconds I have that the Amgen court couldn't be clearer that where something is subject to common proof and is central to the recovery, that it's not for the class certification stage because common issues are going to predominate. The court says it's whether there's a common question, not whether everybody's the same. And the court even goes on to say it's where the it is even when it's you could have even some individual questions as long as the common questions predominate. And I'd like the court just to look at particularly page 12 in the Westlaw portion.
Oh, you have a red light, sir.
I'm sorry, sir.
Okay, back to you, Mr. Curry.
Thank you, Your Honor. First and foremost, I inadvertently misspoke when I said loss causation is not an element. I meant price impact. Loss causation has always been an element of a 10b-5 claim.
Well, you know how I understand it. You end up using them interchangeably.
Yeah, I lost you there.
Like the same thing.
I'm sorry. But they are related, but they're different.
All right.
Lack of proof of price impact kills reliance under the fraud on the market theory. An individual plaintiff can still show individual subjective reliance and can still show loss causation through some other means, as EchoCath that we cited in our letter brief and other cases have recognized.
Could a plaintiff ever prevail with the necessary element of loss causation if the plaintiff couldn't show price impact?
And cases recognize that an individual plaintiff can, because loss causation is really just proximate cause, and that's what Dura says as well.
So aren't we talking about plaintiffs in this class?
An individual shareholder in this class could still recover in an individual action, but not in a fraud on the market
How
class.
Could an individual plaintiff in this class recover if there were no eventual proof of price impact? How could you ever establish loss?
In theory, if a shareholder said, I don't like the way Halliburton switched from one GAAP method of accounting for fixed price contracts to another, and for that reason, I didn't realize it because they didn't disclose that change in time, and that's why I bought the stock, and that somehow is related in a proximate cause sense to the loss, that could do it.
That would go to reliance more than loss, but anyway, that's you know.
But the theoretical possibility exists, Your Honor, and that's the point.
Trouble is, if it's that abstruse a theoretical possibility, then what I see as the underlying logic in the Amgen decision, which I think traces to Easterbrook, makes it problematic for you because it would always be determinative. It would doom the class, and therefore it's not an individualized assessment, not subject to Rule 23.
Again, well, 2 points, yeah. Your Honor. First, you're going to the logic. The holding of Amgen is very clear, and it's materiality right. Only. Counsel misspoke when he said it talked about price impact. Amgen never spoke about price impact. It's about materiality and materiality only. And by the same token, the logic of Amgen, we don't believe it goes that far because, again, price impact, while it's certainly related to loss causation, it goes directly to reliance, as this court recognized in Zonagen. And all it really does at this stage, on this state of the record, is defeat the class-wide presumption of reliance, allowing individual shareholders to still bring their claims on whatever theory they have of reliance and loss causation. Counsel brought up basic footnote 29, and I think it's important to recognize how limited that was and how taken out of context it was. Basic footnote 29 was responding to the dissent's point about the oddities of the holdings of the majority opinion. And in response to that, it's important to note that BASIC was a post-class certification case, but it was also a case that was reviewing a summary judgment order after the close of discovery. The only stage left was trial. Had the court, and so in footnote 29, the majority opinion was responding to the dissent's points about the oddities in this case, saying that can be proven at trial, because that was the only stage left. Had the BASIC majority opinion meant to categorically exclude proof of rebuttal testimony at the time that the presumption is invoked, it would have said so in the more than a half a dozen times it referred to the rebuttable presumption. And it would not have cited to Rule 301 because Rule 301 says nothing of the sort. Judge Higginson brought up the point about this presumption. We are aware of no presumption, and the fund has not cited any, that cannot be rebutted at the time it is invoked. What the fund is arguing is that the fraud on the market presumption, as they interpret it, becomes a super presumption that is irrebuttable until some later time, possibly never. That is plainly inconsistent with
I thought he qualified it and said it's still rebuttable to as to its three basic elements described in BASIC. And then I thought I did hear you say you still felt you could challenge that this was an efficient market.
Every court says you can challenge market efficiency. Every court says you can challenge publicity. Our position is that, as BASIC says, any showing that severs the link between the misrepresentation and the price defeats the presumption and puts the plaintiff on their burden. That type of proof must be considered at the class certification stage, and that's what this Court's unbroken line of precedence going back to Unger has consistently held. For these reasons, we would ask that the Court reverse the order below or, in the alternative, remand with instructions for the Court to reopen briefing and evidence to comply with the revised standard now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen.